Thank you, Brother Mark, and good morning, brothers and sisters in our Lord Jesus Christ. Bring with me the love and the greetings of your brothers and sisters in the Daventry Ecclesia in the UK. We think about a word of exhortation, and it's got several layers to it, hasn't it? There's several ideas that come with the concept of an exhortation. It's to help us focus on our master, of course, to help us to appreciate the scriptures more deeply, to encourage us to love and good works. Thank you. It's an opportunity to help us to take stock and add some focus to our day and the coming week. Maybe it will help us to think about doing things differently from what we have in the previous week. And of course, it's the opportunity to think about and align ourselves with our Lord Jesus Christ in the emblems of bread and of wine. So I want to start with a question. Do things which are meaningful happen by accident? Do things which are meaningful happen by accident? Was it some random chance that brought you here this morning? And whether it be trivial or consequential, things happen according to a structured order. Things happen according to plans and predictable things. Depending on the sort of rota of things that you have organised here at the Bay of Plenty, you know, if you arrived and the meeting room wasn't set up in the way that was an expectation, you'd be able to work out reasonably quickly what went wrong, whose responsibility it might have been, and oh, so-and-so is now sick and there's a problem. We'd be able to work out why things are as they are based on those levels of predictability. And of course, if I stood here to speak a word of exhortation with a little bit of planning and preparation, it wouldn't take a very long time before I dried up and decided it was time to sit down. So it needs a bit of planning and preparation for things to happen in a reasonable way for us. And we're going to come back to that sort of general idea of things of preparation and planning as we work through our exhortation. Now, of course, the way in which the scriptures are presented is really interesting. It's a book full of stories, of narrative, of things which have happened in the past. But rarely, perhaps even if ever, the moral or the lesson of the story isn't given to us. We're given a narrative. We're given an explanation of this is what occurred. But as I say, rarely, if ever, do we get an observation like, and the moral of the story is such and such. It's up to us as readers to be able to draw from the narrative, from the story, an interpretation, a conclusion. Now, of course, that's not to say that the scriptures are not explicit. They are. And you think of the Mosaic Code and the thou shalt do so and so and thou shalt not do so and so. There are things which are very explicit. That's not what I'm referring to. What I'm thinking of is the historical narratives particularly. And we're going to look at a little bit of 1 Kings and chapter 1 as an illustration of that idea. It gives to us a relatively straightforward narrative that this is what occurred. And apart from the occasional but, you're not necessarily given an explanation as to why or what you should think based on what you've read. So to say that King David was an extraordinary man would be one of those sort of English understatements, wouldn't it? You know, he is an extraordinary character in the scriptures. So the first book of Samuel and chapter 16 tells us how extraordinary a man he was. He is described as being ruddy and with all of a beautiful countenance and goodly to look to. Those are pretty good statements, aren't they? If that was to describe any one of us, we wouldn't be necessarily terribly unhappy with that. You see what I mean? And other translations, and some of you may have, something like handsome and with a sparkle in his eyes. So that gives us something which is, again, rather interesting, isn't it? Well, think of his accomplishments. It's 1 Samuel 16, by the way, if anybody wants to make find more of that. The record tells us that he was a gifted musician. He was a poet. He was a man of strength, of courage, of valour. He was a leader both in battle and in peacetime. And if you think about those different characteristics, they don't necessarily go together. You think about the history of military warriors, don't necessarily make peacetime rulers terribly well. But his sin with Bathsheba marked a particular low point, didn't it, in the life of David. But his spiritual farsightedness sets him out as a particularly special character and worthy of our close consideration. But one of the realities of the consequences of his sin with Bathsheba was that there was serious consequences in his life with his family. There were knock-on effects which were unexpected, perhaps, certainly unintended. And those consequences, the thing which he had done compromised his ability to execute the judgment that he might otherwise have chosen to follow through. David's sin with Bathsheba compromised his ability to say, that's wrong, don't do this, and so on. And I think we can see a couple of those things. Nathan the prophet had said to David that the sword would never depart from his house, and the reality of that was shown to be true. His own children behaved abominably, didn't they? And if we think about the implications of that, we are likely to find that to be true also. The things which we do, neglect to do perhaps, they have the effect on us not being able to pursue a particular course of action for fear, perhaps, of being called out as a hypocrite. If we do something and then later on, which is wrong, that is, and later on wish to call out something which we see is wrong in others, we fear, don't we, being called a hypocrite when we then try and pass judgment or make comments on a particular situation. And so in the case of Absalom, David's son, we might infer that David failed to apply the judgment that was needed sufficiently early in his sin with Tamar. So, that's not to say that we shouldn't say things which need to be said, but there's just that risk that we might get called out and have that thing passed back at us, and therefore on that basis we may choose not to say something. So perhaps the usurpation of the throne by Absalom started right back with the rape of his sister Tamar. By the rape of his sister Tamar by her half-brother Amnon. And the unseemly act which then followed led to Absalom conspiring against and causing the murder of Amnon. And from that, Absalom flees into exile, self-imposed exile. But it's clear, isn't it, that Absalom was a favourite amongst the people, and certainly with David and the people at large. We know how the book of Samuel says to us that Absalom stole the hearts of the people. He was from a good family. He was charming and good looking, and his aspirations for power turned his heart against his father. And the combination of all of these features turned out to destructive ends as far as Absalom was concerned. But Absalom off the scene, and David's rule is returned, isn't it? And here we are now in 1 Kings with David back on the throne, but old and stricken in years, as the saying is. Now we have a new pretender to the throne who's getting impatient. So 1 Kings and chapter 1, verse 1. The King David was old and stricken in years. They covered him with clothes, but he gat no heat. Wherefore his servants said to him, "Let there be sought for my lord the king a young virgin, let her stand before the king," and so on. So they sought for such a one, and Abishag, a Shunammite, is brought. Verse 5, then Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself, saying, "I will be king." And he prepared him chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. It's plain language, isn't it? It's something that we can all understand. He had a plan, and he was committed to that plan. He gathered to him all of the accoutrements of power and control. And it's exactly what Absalom had done before him. So we see in the middle of verse 5, he prepared him chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. It's exactly what Absalom had done, as recorded in 2 Samuel 15. And if you think about it, it's the forerunner to the cavalcade or the presidential motorcade, isn't it? It's the demonstration of power and influence. I have all of these people to be able to form part of my coterie. These are the people that are going to support me and add to my power. He's got a clear plan, and he's committed to it, and he's bringing it into effect. And so following on, he has a conference with the high echelons of society, doesn't he? He brings together the priestly and the military. But it's a particular set of those high echelons, isn't it? Joab and Abiathar have their own axes to grind, because they themselves are on borrowed time with David. And of course, the record, as we've read those sort of early verses, the record is explicit for the ones who are not called. And this is human nature, isn't it? If we've got a particular course to pursue, we will get on board those who are sympathetic and influential as early on as we may. And we probably avoid engaging with those we're either trying to supplant or who wouldn't support our cause. But the record gives us some further insight as to the responsibilities. Verse 6 tells us his father had not displeased him at any time in saying, why hast thou done so? And he was a very goodly man. His mother bare him after Absalom. You see, David hasn't given him any reason to think he was acting inappropriately, has he? Maybe we might say that David is old and he isn't in circulation sufficiently to be aware of what's going on. But the fact that the Spirit chooses to record this statement maybe suggests to us that there's a reason to consider that David had somehow, perhaps inadvertently, allowed circumstances to develop in such a way that actually he could or should have acted earlier to limit the damage that would follow. And as a result of that, perhaps we can bring to mind the words in Ecclesiastes which say, because judgment against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. Adonijah had started down a track. David hadn't checked him, as it were, hadn't restricted him. And perhaps that weakness from earlier, the compromising of standards, had limited David's ability. And this principle has lessons for us, doesn't it? It's true of parents with small children. You know, right from an early age, it's important. But it's true as our children move through teenage years also. But it is something that as parents of children, we can do at least something about. When we extend that to our friends and our brothers and sisters, it becomes more and more difficult, doesn't it? To be able to say something which is going to be potentially or perceived to be harsh or a statement of judgment. We perhaps take the view that saying nothing is neutral. Certainly the easier course very often, isn't it? But if you think about it, saying nothing is not a neutral position. Not saying something when you have something to say is equivalent to a lie. You see, it can be almost equivalent to an endorsement or an approval. It's challenging for us to think about, but I think you'll agree that it's true. And it's something that we all do to a greater or a lesser extent. It takes courage to stand up for something which you know to be right and true and beneficial for the person to whom you are speaking. And that's important for us to consider. As an inevitable follow-on from Adonijah gathering his people around him to make him king, there's a great feast which is described in the chapter that we've read. And again, the record makes it explicit that certain people are called and certain people are excluded. Verse 10, Nathan the prophet, Benaiah and the mighty men, and Solomon his brother, he called not. And the narrative then goes on to tell us of the next phase of the drama. Nathan the prophet is now aware of the conspiracy which he's formulating. He discusses the case with Bathsheba, the mother of Solomon, and they've got reasons to be fearful, haven't they? Verse 21 makes that clear to us. And between them, they make preparation to present their case to David. And their preparation, their plan, paid off. Although we didn't read it, we see this in verse 28. The King David answered and said, call me Bathsheba. She came into the king's presence and stood before the king. The king swore and said, thus and so, which we'll see in a second. See, this lovely speech which follows on, it is David now accepting what's required and taking action to make sure that things which he knows should occur actually take place. Verse 29 and 30, the king swore and said, as the Lord liveth, that hath redeemed my soul out of all distress, even as I swear unto thee by the Lord God of Israel, saying, assuredly Solomon thy son shall reign after me, and he shall sit upon my throne in my stead, even so will I certainly do this day. Now, to the best of my knowledge, and please tell me if I've got this wrong, but to the best of my knowledge, we don't have a specific record of the oath being made to Bathsheba. But there's no doubt that it must have been so, because of the way in which the record presented here. But then David gives a series of commands that get his military chiefs organized, his priests and his courtiers mobilized to bring to effect the requirements which he has. Now, although we haven't read the entirety of the chapter, there's something I want you to also, you'll perhaps realize this from previous readings. If we read through this record generally, Solomon is silent as far as the record is concerned. He only speaks from the record of the Spirit given to us after he's appointed king, and only then it's in connection with the judgment against Adonijah. So what preparation was Solomon making for kingship? The record presents him being somewhat in the background. It's others who bring him to the fore. In a sense, it's just as it was with David, called from his role as shepherd, brought into focus to stand before Samuel. So it seems to me we've got a really striking contrast between these two principal characters of the drama. Adonijah makes preparation for his own exaltation, whereas Solomon is content to wait until he is called to come up higher. So let's think about the purpose of exhortation once again. What are you preparing for? Depending on our age range, it could be a number of different things, couldn't it? If you are our youngest, it might be exams, be they school, college, or whatever. It could be a degree. Could be preparation for an interview. Could be job promotion, couldn't it, that we're preparing for. Could be retirement. There could be all sorts of things for our personal well-being. And these things are not wrong in themselves, are they? That's not the point that we're trying to make. It's the level of focus that we apply to the things which are for our personal benefit, compared to the more ultimate spiritual plans and the things which concern eternal matters. We're motivated to prepare for something to which we are committed. Earlier in David's life, we've got the record of his focus on the Ark of God, preparing a dwelling place for it. It was a task to which he was fully committed. He was motivated to pursue it. He made strong preparation for it. So let's ask ourselves the question again. To what are you committed, and for what are you making preparation? And David has shown his commitment in bringing the ark to Zion, but he also wanted to build for it a permanent house, didn't he? And then the narrative at the end of the first of Chronicles tells us that he prepared materials in abundance. It was Solomon that executed the building of the house, as 2 Chronicles 8 tells us. All the work of Solomon was prepared unto the day of the foundation of the house of the Lord, and until it was finished, and so the house of the Lord was perfected. We know that as the kingdom progressed, that there were reverses and declines until the reforms of Josiah, when he diligently set about bringing back the focus to divine worship. We need to turn this up because I don't have it written down. Second of Chronicles and chapter 35. We're moving on to consider Josiah. 2 Chronicles and chapter 35. And we'll just pick out one or two verses. 2 Chronicles 35 and just verse 1. Moreover, Josiah kept a Passover unto the Lord in Jerusalem. They killed the Passover on the 14th day of the first month, and so on. And verse 4. And prepare yourselves by your houses of your fathers, by the houses of your fathers, after your courses, according to the writing of David, king of Israel. And verse 6, so kill the Passover and sanctify yourselves and prepare your brethren, that they may do according to the word of the Lord by the hand of Moses. And also verse 10, so the service was prepared, and the priests stood in their place, and the Levites in their courses, according to the king's commandment. You see, they had committed to do something, and they were now preparing diligently to bring it into effect. After the captivity and the return of the exiles, over a page or two into the book of Ezra, Ezra was one who was a ready scribe in the law of Moses. And in chapter 7 of Ezra and verse 10, we are told that Ezra had prepared his heart to seek the law of the Lord and to do it, and to teach in Israel statutes and judgments. And so let's ask ourselves the question again. To what are you committed and making preparation? As the time drew near for the manifestation of the Son of God, all men mused in their hearts of John, whether he were the Christ or not. And the Spirit in John the Baptist said that he was the voice of one crying in the wilderness to do what? To prepare the way of the Lord. The Gospel of Matthew in chapter 25 records that well-known parable of the wise and the foolish virgins. Although it was true that all slumbered and slept, those that were wise had made preparation beforehand of sufficient oil for the task ahead. They were committed to the task. They knew that what was required, and they were committed to being ready for the bridegroom. To what then Are you committed and making preparation? The Gospel of Luke, please, with me, if you would. In chapter 9 of Luke's Gospel record, we find that the Lord is steadfastly setting his face to go to Jerusalem. Chapter 9 of Luke's Gospel record, verse 51. It came to pass, when the time was come that he should be received up, he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem, and sent messengers before his face. And they went and entered into a village of the Samaritans to make ready for him. He was making preparation. He was fully committed to the task which he had taken on. All his life he had been preparing for this one thing. As the Passover approaches, his disciples ask him, where should they make preparation that they may partake of the Passover together? It's Mark 14, amongst others. And so physical and material preparation was required, just as it is for us, preparing ourselves and the room. But there's also that mental preparation, isn't there? Required to allow the scriptures to have their intended effect on our hearts and minds, such that we might be prepared to commune with our God. So we have an example in many characters who prepared themselves for the cause to which they were committed. David, Solomon, Josiah, Ezra, the disciples of the Lord, and of course, the Lord himself, one who was committed to the manifestation of the will of his Father. Let us then be prepared to fully commit to the cause for which we have set our hearts and our minds upon. Thank you.